all for Silas, all for Silas. Welcome to episode 8 of Animation Station. Today we are reviewing the adventures of Mark Twain. I'm Tracy.
And I'm Robbie.
So, let's get into it.
Yeah.
We both went into this movie kind of blindly. Robbie had noticed it on Netflix, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we had initially read, like, when we were looking at lists of movies we want to talk about.
Yeah.
I saw it on a list, and then it popped up on Netflix, and I got really excited.
It was bopping around my queue for a while, too, because I was, like, looking at it. I was like, I don't know, like, because I'd never seen a trailer for it. I was kind of familiar with the animator, though, Will Vinton, because if you guys have any history with stop-motion animation, he's the guy that did the animation for the California Raisins, Domino's Pizza, The Noid. This is all stuff in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you don't know what it is, it's okay. It just means you're not in your 30s.
Yeah.
So, which is fine. I only know it because of VH1, as it raised me in my formative years. So, but no, yeah. So he's a very well-known stop-motion animator. He coined the term claymation, didn't
yes.
he? Yeah, yeah.
So he's often heralded as the father of claymation.
Mm-hmm. He's even worked with Michael Jackson, so... Yeah.
Yeah, he's made it. Something in that
movie. I think it was in Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, the actual movie.
It was in Moonwalker.
I think it was, there's this one scene where he's dancing with a rabbit that also has, like, his, I don't want to call it a jerry curl, but it kind of looks like one.
It's
a bit of a jerry curl. But when Michael Jackson has his rabbit doppelganger and they're dancing together,
okay.
That was a sequence that he had animated.
Yes, so. That makes sense.
But yeah.
So Will Vinton directed this movie, and I was reading it. I have the interview up, but I don't remember. I'm not going to scroll through it right now. But
no worries.
Him and one of the writers, I think, when they were initially conceiving it, they had started with The Adam and Eve,
mm-hmm.
The Diary of Adam and Eve. And then I think either while they were working on that or... he was reading a bunch of the book, like the complete works of Mark Twain. And then they were like, we're going to make this into a full movie.
Because he's actually a really fascinating character.
Yeah,
like,
I love Mark Twain.
Like, I don't really have that much exposure to him outside of, like, Wishbone.
Yeah, right.
I'll be honest.
I think most
people know the Tom Sawyer story, or they know enough about it from pop culture to be able to pick up what was going on with it, or to
Tom
a lesser
Sawyer,
extent.
Tom Sawyer, you tricked me. This is not as fun as previously indicated.
Quit complaining and keep whitewashing. Well, it just makes me think of the Simpsons episode where, like, eventually Tom and Huck are watching Tom's funeral, but then it turns out that the bodies have been, like, covered in formaldehyde and they're lowered into the casket.
That.
I was like, oh, it's kind of dark, guys.
Well,
or where they go down the water slide and the photographer, a woman's like, one guy's like, good lord, I can see that woman's ankle. And the photographer's like, oh, let me just dispose of that. And then he puts it into his pocket and walks away and he's like, all for Silas, all for Silas. That for a while, that was my exposure to Mark Twain.
Yeah, yeah.
But the more I kept watching the movie, I'm like, I really want to read these stories now.
I've not read enough Mark Twain. I mean,
but he's just got such a dynamite sense of humor.
He really does, which, like, especially, like, in the last, 5 minutes of the film, he's great.
Yeah,
like,
he quips like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, he's great.
At least in the movie.
One of my favorite Mark Twain quotes is, two wrongs doesn't make a right. But three does.
I love that one.
I
was wondering where I heard that, because I remember hearing that one.
Oh, I used to say that all the time.
Wait, did he coin the early bird gets the worm thing, too? Or, I don't know
if he coined the term the early bird gets the worm, but I definitely know he had at least one quip regarding that.
I'm certain he did.
The man is the original satirist, American satirist.
Which I love, it's just Stephen Colbert, but back during the...
No, yeah, I mean, he started, he literally started that trend of a comedian making legitimate political criticism.
That's awesome.
Like, that wasn't a thing until Mark Twain.
That's so perfect.
Yeah, so, like...
And he's from Missouri.
Yes, he is.
Which I love.
He is from Missouri.
Yep.
Hannibal,
Missouri.
Was it Hannibal?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
Or that, or at least I think that's where the Mark Twain Museum is.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's a thing. People, I would totally go there.
I haven't been there yet.
Heck yeah, I would totally go there.
It's definitely a thing.
I just haven't spent enough time around Truman or wherever Hannibal is. Where is Hannibal? I feel like it's in the northeastern part of Missouri.
What do I look like, a person who knows geography?
I don't know. I'm just asking. You went to school around Southern Illinois. I don't know.
Yeah, I went to school in Southern Illinois.
So. Yeah, but I don't know. That's okay. Backtracking. So
back on the topic of the movie.
Yes. You know, the reason you're listening to this.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
The movie is kind of set in this sort of weird meta space in which all the characters, Tom Sawyer, mm-hmm. Huck Finn, and Becky...
Thatcher.
Yeah. Is it Becky or Betty?
Whatever. Becky. Yeah.
Becky Thatcher.
Like Rebecca.
Right. Yeah. All three of them exist, obviously, so it kind of is set in that world, but Mark Twain is also a character in it.
Well, like, the movie opens up like it's, like a standard fairy tale where it has the book that opens up and starts telling you the story.
Right, yeah, it's a beautiful opening.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, so great. That, like, the way that they animate water, amazing!
Yeah, yeah.
Because it dawns on you after about maybe 25 seconds, like, oh, wait, literally everything is clay. Everything is claymation.
Yeah, and that was a thing they leaned into as hard as they could.
Which I thought was incredible, because it's, like, number one, like, just from a technical standpoint, you're like, how were they able to manipulate the clay in such a way? Because, all right, so if you're shooting with clay or any kind of, like, medium that you have to manipulate, with stop motion, with the lighting that you have to use, especially for a set like that, you would think that that would affect the lights mm-hmm. because of the heat from the lights being on all the time. You would think that would make the clay more difficult to work with. So I was just sitting there for the first, like, minute or so, like, how did they get it to behave? Like,
so much in the movie, Tracy was just like, how did they do this? I want to know that.
Well, because I kind of went to school for that, and I didn't make a claymation. A good friend of mine had made one that was about a Yeti. Which is great. But she had actually made the set herself, where it was just like a platform that she had covered with things like spray painted cones, like things that look like trees, and the rest of it was just like a painted deck.
Okay.
So, that was also the look that she was going for too.
Right. Yeah.
So when you see claymation stuff, it's just like you have to factor in that there are so many people that are still touching this. And they have to manipulate it and move it in such a way where I didn't even see any fingerprints.
No, yeah,
which I thought
was
really strange.
They were very careful about that.
Yeah,
it reminds me of you remember back when Paranorman was
like
big,
yeah.
as though it just stopped being big.
It came out three years ago, I think. Thereabouts, yeah.
Anywho, there's a great a video of someone like an animator working on it.
Yeah,
and so it was like. Norman's trying to walk and he's waving the animator off. Like moving him. It was a really cool little video.
I love those. They've that company themselves.
They do very good stuff.
They do. And like I love the way that how they do their kind of informational videos about like this is the actual process of it.
Oh,
like
yeah.
This is how we these are all the different mouths that we have to use to supplement mm-hmm. them for different scenes. Like this person has so many heads.
They did one on the Paranorman DVD about how they animated the whole witch thing in that movie. And it's fascinating.
Really cool.
Yeah, very cool stuff.
And especially when you see all of the puppets that they had for the in-betweens of when Abigail is freaking out mm-hmm. and she's getting really extreme poses with her head. It's so cool. I want one of those puppets. This would be so cool.
Yeah, yeah. So back on the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Paranorman, watch it.
Sorry, I was geeking out for a second there.
Man.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
I don't always apologize to you. that was unnecessarily hostile. I'm sorry.
Sorry, guys. It's late. We're a little tired.
Yeah, we're recording this actually directly after watching it, which is weird for us. Usually,
our rawest
feelings
on this movie.
Well, I mean, generally when we record, it's a couple days afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
Just
some time to like simmer and think about it.
Well, yeah, because our schedules are kind of weird. So. And that, especially this upcoming weekend.
This weekend's
going
to be crazy, so
we're
recording
earlier. That's not going to change the fact that we're getting this thing out on time.
We're trying.
So, yeah.
So Mark Twain is a character within,
this,
who exists in the same world as Tom Sawyer and Huck mm-hmm. Finn and all these. Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn and Becky end up sneaking onto his weird Halloween castle.
Steampunky, kind of huge dirigible, whatever you want to call it.
Which was a super neat,
It was incredibly high tech.
Super, the whole thing is super cool.
It was like crossing the Millennium Falcon with the Hindenburg, but in a good way.
Yeah.
In like a fun way.
Yeah.
And not in like an exploding in death way. Oh no, look at them. But
there
yeah.
They go.
there they go. Let's see where the people.
So they, so it's kind of a bunch of almost vignettes of Mark Twain's stories,
mm-hmm.
and the sort of the vehicle for moving from segment to segment is this in-between part with these kids and Mark Twain, who is
he's who both is like chasing the mentor Haley's and the comet. Guide. Yeah, yeah, and he's and like
he's sort of this weird. He's both like a mentor character, but also as we see at the end of the movie, sort of an antagonist,
kind of in some ways, yeah, sort of. But yeah, but so and he's chasing Haley's comet,
right?
Yeah,
because Samuel Clemens, the actual mm-hmm.
yeah.
name of the actual man,
yeah. Mark Twain is his pen name.
Yes,
yeah.
If you somehow didn't know that yet, not exactly the literary world's greatest secret.
No, not quite. Well, for a while, it didn't really take him that long to. It's about as closely guided as Dr. Seuss's real name.
Yeah. Right.
So, in that you generally know what it is. It's Theodore Geisel.
Oh. She saw it.
Apparently, Robbie didn't know. Whoopsie doodle.
Whatever. So, anywho, he was actually born the same year, and I think within, like, a week or so of Halley's Comet.
Mm-hmm.
And then died literally the day after it came back in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, why they have him chasing the comet in the movie, set in 1910.
Yeah.
So, the first vignette that they jump into is, I think it's the Diary of Adam and Eve.
It's the one with the frog, remember?
Oh, yeah, oh my God, I forgot about that.
With, what was it, Daniel?
It's like the greatest frog in...
Yeah. I forget what his name...
Well,
yeah,
like
because they'd shortened his name or something to, like, show that, like, was Southern. But, I think it was, like, Daniel something. Like, Daniel whatever.
Which
something
was
about a frog.
Yeah, it was a goofy little story of a man who taught a frog to jump extremely high because you can educate frogs.
Apparently.
And
like,
then,
because if you can educate a frog, then
you
can do pretty much anything. Yeah.
So,
not inaccurate.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, like, really if you have enough patience and, like, have the willpower
to
train
to a frog
to do something,
good on you.
I salute you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, let's start another vaccine, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, actually, wait, are there any other major illnesses that we can make a vaccine for right now?
I don't know. Maybe.
Common cold. That'd be nice.
Yeah, that'd be neat.
Yeah, I mean, see, if you can make a thing if you can somehow manage to teach a frog to, I don't know, do basic
chemistry.
I was thinking basic multiplication. Like, I'm sure you could probably create a vaccine for the common cold.
Huh.
Get on it, guys. Come on, biology majors, what's up?
Biochem, looking at you.
Yeah, come on.
Slack
it off.
So there's, it's this goofy little frog story in which a man teaches a frog to jump really high,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, I bet you $40, which obviously at that time was
a stupid amount of money.
Yeah, just way much...
Yeah.
Way more money.
Yeah.
I'll bet you $40 that you can grab any other frog and he won't jump the same way. And while he's gone, the guy he bets, who's an out-of-towner, loads the frog.
Yeah. He basically force-feeds him.
Like anything he can find.
Well, I think I remember seeing, like, a skillet with bacon and eggs still inside of it. Like, a bear trap, some books.
Yeah, just tons of stuff.
Possibly a Rubik's Cube. I don't know.
Right, so the frog can't jump because there's all the junk in his belly.
Yeah.
And thus he cheats, like, the whole town and then leaves.
Yeah. And then afterwards, the guy realizes, wait, someone done fed my frog all these metal things.
Yeah. So there was that one, and then it goes to the Diary of Adam and Eve,
mm-hmm.
Which was sort of this interesting portrait of Adam and Eve as told by Mark Twain, because one thing I was reading is that Mark Twain, while he's technically a Christian,
mm-hmm.
One, he's obviously very skeptical and sort of cynical of organized religion,
mm-hmm.
Two, he's not overly fond of the way that the Bible treats its characters,
mm-hmm.
because they're really only...
Like, are they presented as either all good or all bad?
Sort of. They're only... Like, I mean, they're
I,
only
I find
there
characters like that are so
sort of,
boring.
Yeah, they're only like, there to be sort of cardboard stand-ups to make moral lessons.
And that's a really childish approach to storytelling, right, exactly. In my opinion. So where it's like, if you're presenting people with, like, either people are all good or all bad, it's like, there's no real lessons to be learned, because they'll have very strict guidelines of how they choose to, like, approach lessons.
The characters aren't fleshed out at all, yeah. Right? They're not real people.
Yeah, like, there's no, like, well, so, sometimes people make these kinds of decisions.
Right, so... Mark Twain obviously was not a fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Diary of Adam and Eve is sort of this interesting portrait of what if they were, you know, actual people.
Yeah.
So it ends up being a very sweet story when they get to the end of it, you know, mm-hmm. much later, but initially it's sort of this goofy, like,
it's almost like a sitcom. Yeah.
When I was looking at it, I'm like, Adam is the original sitcom dad.
He kind of looks like Al Bundy. Like, he's really bumbling and really everything.
He's fairly stupid.
Yeah, like, he's just sort of like, well, I may as well go do this thing, you know? Like, right. He has no discernible aim. He's just all about relaxing and chilling out.
Right, and he's very much, like, avoidant of Eve for a lot of it.
Well, I think you might. He's also, like, intimidated by her because the Eve in this story is very curious and she's very smart. She likes to analyze and experiment with different things. Where she goes through and names everything within Eden.
Yeah, which is very funny.
She learns, I think, architecture. Like, wait, did she build that house or did Adam? But then Eve was able to duplicate it almost immediately.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. He built a house, and then she duplicated the house right next to him.
Yeah.
But I remember...
But no, yeah, so, and Eve can, she can just go through, like, like, she studies everything. She keeps little notes about, like, all her findings, and she studies Adam as though he's some kind of, like, animal in a cage. Well, yeah, that's that first,
when she's looking at him, yeah. She's like...
She's like, I don't really know what to make of him.
I think he's a reptile, but he could be architecture.
Yeah. And there's some great transformation animation that goes from, like, him having dinosaur feet to looking like a giant, like, birdhouse, or, like, a
mailbox. Yeah, he's got, like, essentially from, like, his waist up, he's, like, a house.
Yeah, he's, like, a little brick house. Brick house.
Sorry.
We're very tired. But yeah, like, I thought that Adam and Eve story was really, I thought it was kind of unique in the way that it sort of presents how different the way that Adam and Eve approach each other is. That initially Adam is very standoffish, where he's like, I don't really want to have anything more to do with her.
Right.
And Eve is, she's very intent on studying Adam by any means necessary.
Yeah, right, like the scene where she's like, he set up a fishing pole to catch the fish, and I started throwing rocks at him to make him stop, because I want him in the tree again.
And his incessant trips going down the waterfalls and different kinds of, like, he, like, goes down them in a bathtub, he goes down them in an inner tube, in, like, a raft or something, maybe a canoe, I forget.
A surfboard at one point.
Yeah, there's a surfboard where it's just, like, I think they just wanted as many opportunities to use the waterfall set as possible, which is fine, because I thought it was great.
Yeah, and it probably took a lot of work, so yeah. Why not?
No, yeah, for sure. Like, I thought it was great. But,
So that was an interesting,
And then the snake finally comes in.
Yeah, the snake who, sunglasses.
Sorry.
Which I loved.
Yeah. He wears sunglasses. He kind of looks like, I don't know, like he's covered in pepperoni or something. Because of his red scales, I was like, man, I wish that snake was made out of pepperoni.
Jump
right in. Bite into it. You lied to me! I would do it.
Bite into a pepperoni
snake. Oh, heck yeah. Right. Yeah, why not? What else is it? What else would one do with a pepperoni snake?
You got me there. Make pizza.
Yes. Yes, we can make a pizza. Anyway.
Lord Bigfoot.
Let's grow a Bigfoot.
Alright. So she eats the apple, and then it's this, you know, it's the obviously, like, the way the movie does this is an amazing, like, world-ending transition.
He's like, whoa, hold on, you guys broke rule number one, sorry. No, this isn't happening.
That's not the thing, it was like the universe. Oh, no.
He let, like, a sad version of the Kool-Aid Man.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, because, like, when he's initially... when the
guys,
world,
why didn't you guys read the lease?
When they were... When the world was initially being created, which was a really... Another, like, super cool scene.
Yeah.
But you just have, like, so, that's good.
That's pretty
that's
cool.
That's cute.
I think they'll like that.
Yeah. Like, essentially God commented
like, God goes to Pottery Barn and then just, like, he's like, you know, I bet these curtains would go a lot better in the bathroom than the kitchen. Like, he's got such a great eye for interior design. And like, what, like, he, and he puts a line and a lamp stain together. It's like, there we go. All nice and cute.
Yeah, this is very fun.
Thanks,
so
man.
Like, as soon as she eats the apple, he's like, no, you did the bad thing.
Come on, guys.
It was really funny. And then, I think they, something, they were actually going
he
to.
He sounds so bummed.
He does. Like, oh, I thought this would be cool.
Come on.
Why'd you have to spill beer on my dad's couch?
The one thing I asked you guys not to do and you did it. No more parties, okay?
Get out of my freaking house.
What did I say about eating the apples, Eve? To not do that, exactly.
And what'd you do?
Yeah, you ate the apples. He's like the dad that's super disappointed in you, where it's like, I genuinely expected better out of you. Don't be like your brother.
Your brother who has a motorcycle.
Your brother who has a motorcycle and freeloads at dinner.
Yep.
Doesn't even give in the time of day. Stupid. Just drops by. Expects us to feed him.
Stupid Kane.
Yeah. You know what, Kane? Why don't you just leave?
In a later scene, we see, like, Adam and Eve have had, like, grown together and had a family, and for some reason, Kane's like a straight-up 1950s biker.
Yeah, like, well, he's reclining on his bike,
he's picking his teeth, and, like, eating or something.
With their, like, 20-some-odd children.
Yeah.
It's like, you sure you're one of mine? I just know you're gonna fail, Dewey. You're never gonna make it. But yeah.
So then there's something going on in the, like, on the ship with the, you know, the kids and Mark. So they have to attend to that, and the story gets left off, and then
there's a transporter that they noticed that.
Yeah. So that, well, no, they were just reading the book, and then they have to transport up to the deck to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's done, then they transport down. And they see, like, a bunch of, like, snippets of stories. Like, you see, I think that's the point when they see, like, the Adventures of Tom Sawyer,
mm-hmm.
door, and for a brief second, Tom gets yanked into it, and then...
By his Aunt Polly, where she's like, you need to go back to whitewashing.
I'm washing his pants. And then they see, I think Mark Twain walks out of one.
Yeah.
Seeming very dour, and then sets another door to open the mysterious stranger, which is the only scene we had seen previously, which
I really liked.
I did too.
It's definitely really messed up.
Like. Yeah, well, when I watched it the other night, I definitely got, like, sort of Uncanny Valley feel from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're supposed to.
Yeah, you're absolutely supposed to. But so the Mysterious Stranger is an unfinished story of Mark Twain's.
Yeah, which I did not know.
Me neither until after where I was looking stuff up.
Yeah.
And he started writing it after his wife and daughter died when he was in dire financial straits. So
messed up.
When you watch this scene,
it makes complete
sense.
You're like,
oh, that's why.
It's like, oh, he seems like a person who was incredibly depressed when he wrote this.
Well, that definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's this weird angel named Satan,
mm-hmm.
who
is a mask that's suspended on, like, a stick.
Well, yeah,
he's basically,
like,
just like a torso without a head. Like, he's got, like, a torso and then, like, a kind of...
Yeah, it's
like,
he just
like
kind
he's
of
got, like, a gown or something. Like,
it kind of seemed to be made of sand to me, so it seems like he just kind of grew up from the ground.
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, he
gets
just had this sort of weird
some
suit
impeccable
of armor,
shoulder pads, by the way.
And then just holds up a mask, mm-hmm. like a masquerade.
Yeah, like he's at a masquerade bar.
Yeah, that, like, morphs.
Yeah. But it looks like it's one of those, you know, those, like, those comedy and tragedy masks that you would see at, like, a theater?
Yeah,
it's supposed to be stylized as one of those, like, kind of blank masks, but it keeps being manipulated.
Keeps shifting.
Like, as he's got his changing emotions, like, the mask changes accordingly.
Right. So. So in this scene, he creates like a tiny kingdom and then has the kids create people and then he gives them life and then washes them for a bit. And as he kills all of them, provides this disturbing commentary about how awful people are and how he just doesn't get it.
Well, I like the fact that he's driven to crush them because they're happy and they're cheering and they're, like, conversing with each other. And, like, the actual, like, the little people where he's like, oh, that horrible noise of fun and...
Oh, no, 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 because that was after they, I think he squashed them.
Well, no, he squashed them, then they started crying, then he's like, that noise is worse, now I want them dead.
Yeah, then he starts killing.
Yeah.
And so he just kills all these little people.
Which is obviously, cool. I mean, like, because they're, like, running away. He, like, crushes a horse. Like, he...
He zaps several of them.
Yeah.
He opens, like, the little earth, and they fall into the cracks.
Yeah, he basically causes an earthquake to rupture their little world, and it's like, these poor little clay people.
Yeah, yeah, which is
seeing that cow go over the edge was like, no, Mr. Cow. I did say that when I was watching it. I have a tendency to call animals Mr. Yeah, regardless of even if they're acknowledged as a woman. Yeah. I'm just like, Mr. Dog.
Mr. Dog.
But, yeah, so.
So that happens, and then the kids are like, this is messed up. We gotta go.
Yeah, they're like, we don't like the fact that you murdered those little people.
Yeah, like, they straight up bolt, and
he's just left on his island all alone, where he's like, well, I guess I can just disintegrate into something cool. I guess I can just
monologue for a bit.
Well, my platforms disappear.
Yeah, that was actually a cool transition. Like, you see, like, his face, and then fades into Mark Twain's eye.
Yeah. That was really cool.
And they will, and I think from there, the next, like, chunk of it is them trying to figure out, how are we going to get home? Because I don't think we're going to get home on this airship, because he intends to meet the comet. And probably die.
Yeah, and if he dies, they don't really know how to steer it back, but right. While the story goes on, he starts training them how to manage the ship.
Right.
So, was helpful, I thought.
So, they've devised some kind of device to break the power supply, which I guess I don't know what the intent there was.
I don't
know. But it's Tom Sawyer. His plans are 100% half-baked.
Yeah. Under no circumstances has he ever had a plan that actually worked, wherein generally it gets heavily...
It gets heavily
worked out by Huck.
Yeah, well, and even if he does have a plan that could work, he doesn't think far enough to, like, well, what's the next step? Like,
yeah.
I've cut our power source. And?
And?
Like, here's the boat.
Here's the ship. And in the middle of the night, we'll get some provisions and sail back to Spain.
Right.
Right.
How do we get out of here? So we get a rowboat. It's the opposite of that problem where he's thought as far as escaping, but he hasn't thought of what next.
Where, like, he's all about having the means, but there's no discernible end.
It's just
like, okay, we've got this thing, and it's like, okay, great, now what do we do with it?
Yeah, like, well...
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
I've created a screaming robot. What? Why would you do that?
But, so then the story goes back into, we cut back into the story with Adam and Eve.
Yeah, the Adam and Eve. Yeah.
Which has a nice little kind of resolution.
Yeah, it's post.
Once they're kicked out of Eden,
right? Like, ends up being actually like a very sort of sweet.
And oddly enough, it works out for the best. They're like, you know what? I'm glad that we got the knowledge anyway. Where it's you know what, Eve? I get that at the time it was not really that cool for you to eat that apple, but you know what? It was worth it because look at this really cool life that we've built together.
It was very sweet.
Yeah,
and then. Once that finishes, they have to somehow, because they've cut the power because of Tom's plan, so they have to figure out how to get it, you know, back on course, essentially, and, you know, not all die.
Yeah.
Which, in fairness, was Twain's plan anyways, but hey.
But I think he didn't want to take out three children, especially three children that he created
with him. We accidentally skipped over...
Which part?
The trip to heaven.
That segment felt like kind of a non sequitur, to be honest.
It did a little bit. I think it just feeds into more of, like, Twain's perceptions of religion, where it ultimately ends up being this guy goes to heaven, and he ends up on this weird cloud with a bunch of, like, like creepy, like three-headed people, and yeah. then, like, when he go, when he actually opens the door to heaven,
it's just full of blue aliens everywhere. It's full of
aliens in, like, just debaucherous party.
And they're really obnoxious. Like, they're all dancing to disco. Obnoxious. They alternate between, like, partying and smoking cigars and stuff, and it's like,
so it's really,
I don't really know what to make of this, and I think he's like, this is not what I imagine heaven would be.
Right, and so like,
he's like, I'm gonna peace out.
And he's like, well, I guess heaven, you know, each man has his own heaven.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is sort of a neat...
But at the same time, I would rather not have a rave with some blue aliens instead of three heads.
Me too.
I would not have any fun with that, I don't think.
I don't think so either.
No.
But yeah, that was a little tidbit, which actually, again, was another story he wrote, Captain Something Goes to Heaven or something. So once they get the ship sort of back on course, he's like, well, this is it. We've met the comet. And you see that there are two Mark Twains, one who has been speaking with him the whole time and who is clearly much more lively and has a white suit, and then another one who looks like he's been around for 500 years.
Yes.
And wears an all black suit. And he's like, well, this is the dark half of me.
Yeah. And he's like, well, but we have to fuse together because this makes me a full human. Like, this makes me who I am.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he ascends up to heaven to join the skies. Or, like, he becomes a cloud person.
Yeah, which was really cool. They animated his face in this giant yellow.
He did look like cloud. He was made of butter.
Right?
He did look like he was made of butter.
So beautifully crafted. I love it. And that's pretty much, the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, like, did we miss any other sequences?
No, because I think those were it. I mean, Injun Joe wasn't a sequence so much as it was, like, a terror.
It was just, like, a terrifying cutaway.
Well, because
it was like having a screamer in the middle of the movie, because it's, like,
this
horrifying person, like, almost, like, Large Marge, but crossed with, like, Mowgli from... Jungle Book? I don't know. Like, I don't really know what look they were going for, but it was creepy. We're going for
racist alien.
They were going for something based on the name Injun Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just didn't want to see a guy with scraggly hair wearing, like, I don't know, like just, like, brandishing a knife.
Yeah, this is terrifying. I liked it when they first found it, and they just opened the door and just screamed.
And they're just like, nope, nope.
Because I just find the idea of opening a door and just immediate screaming funny. But yeah,
it works in Harry Potter.
Kind of a weird,
housekeeping. I'll come back.
Never mind. But yeah, that's pretty much the movie.
I enjoy it because, like, parts of it I thought were a little bit strange just because it was kind of difficult to... Or, for me, it was a little bit weird to get used to the pacing of some of the characters, but it's also stop motion. So, like, if they had super fast stop motion, it would be really uncanny and weird.
Yeah, so uncomfortable.
Yeah. And, like, especially that style in the 80s. It just took its time a little bit longer. That's also part of Will Vinton's style, which I like.
Yeah, well, except for the heavens bit, which was kind of off. I think the pacing all around kind of worked for the movie, though. I mean,
yeah, I would say so.
You know,
I mean, it felt appropriate for every scene that was supposed to be in there. I think that maybe some of the Adam and Eve stuff went on a little bit too long. Yeah,
that
one.
That also it.
But it also reminded me of there was a note that we looked up that said that they had that Wilvin and his team had initially released that as like a teaser to get some investors involved with it.
They were kind of working on that. So
if there's kind of a different tonal shift with it, that's why.
Yeah, yeah, that probably has a lot to do with it, because they animated that initially.
Yeah.
We may have said that already.
I don't know, but, well, even if we did, we're going to reiterate it now just to show, like, well, that's kind of how it got some of its money anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So. I don't know if this is just like a thing within animation or if it's just a thing we have consistently noticed, but it's in every movie a director voices some sort of minor part. So in this one, for the Stranger Satan, what they did was they recorded a man and a woman, and then just
and then spliced them together. Yeah,
So the director was the male half.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. And the woman that voiced Becky was the female half of the mysterious stranger.
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And also there's an internet rumor for some reason that the mysterious stranger piece was cut out in television airings, and that never happened. And that was actually, like, it was a point of contention for the team that they wanted to be PG and not G.
That's true. Well, I mean, like, for scenes like that and for Injun Joe and for some of the Adam and Eve stuff.
You would think that would get a PG, but no.
You would assume so. Well, yeah,
straight
but...
straight up G rating.
Well, let's see. Well, what was it?
But in 1985...
Well, yeah, because the movie that set the standard for the PG rating was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Like, that, the rating was set up because of that movie.
Was that the PG?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that was the first one. That was the first... It should have had a PG-13.
That's what I'm saying.
The PG rating was invented for Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Yeah.
Huh.
Well, there's some gross-out stuff. Some of the... there's some sexual content in there that's not super appropriate. It's not, like, graphic, but there's a lot of innuendo and stuff in it, too. Right. And all the violence.
Right.
They're so like, after a certain point, we need a threshold of what we think kids can handle at that age. So,
movies we think a parent should be present for.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, with this movie, there's not really anything that's, like, super inappropriate. There's definitely some disturbing imagery, but you can't really... Well, at the time, they didn't really knock points down for that.
I think that's the point. It's like in 1985, you get away with rating this in G. I think now this movie's probably a hard PG.
I would say a hard PG. I mean, because I was thinking to compare it to Coraline, which is probably a modern counterpoint, sort of. In that Coraline, it kind of examines an Alice in Wonderland-esque story about a girl that gets trapped in a different... Or, like, she goes between different worlds. But a lot of the content in it can be kind of disturbing. There's a lot of scary imagery, and the way the characters kind of interact with each other can either get a little bit inappropriate or comes across as, well, abusive, like, especially with the other mother. She's physically and verbally abusive to Coraline.
Right.
So, but with a movie like this, I liked how many chances it took. Especially how ambitious and what a huge scale the film was.
Yeah.
Can you describe more about, like, what their working environment was for it?
I can actually, let me, because I was actually reading this and I don't remember everything, but I can.
You'd mentioned that they had basically had, it was like a house. That was their set, more or less.
So, another one of the rumors about this movie is that it was produced by a 17-person crew on a $1.5 million budget, working in a basement in 4 years.
Yeah.
And Will Vinton's like, yeah, that's all technically true. It's a little blown out of proportion. 17 people is, like, the full-time, like, character animators and people who were there all the time.
Yeah.
Freelance people were in and out, not to mention, like, voice actors, music, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Presumably they're having more than 17 people involved in a film of this scale.
Exactly. Well, again, for $1.5 million.
Yeah, like, which is, I mean... It's still peanuts for any, like, major film to be made, like, nowadays.
Like, nowadays that would be around 32...
The budget of that, no, that'd be $3.2 million nowadays.
Yeah, $3.2 million
if it was 1.5 and 85.
Yeah, it's about double. So what Will Vinton says is they had a converted house with a barbershop in front, and they called it the barbershop studio. The bedrooms became offices and editing rooms, and the high-ceilinged basement was conveniently connected to a 4,000-foot... Holy crap, okay.
What?
The high-ceiling basement was conveniently connected to a 4,000-square-foot studio that they built in the back, and the basement was where the animators and sculptors worked out the characters.
In the basement?
So it was technically a basement, but it was also...
How big is this house if they can have a high-ceiling basement?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, that'd be the strangest thing where it's like, man, your upper house is really tiny, but your basement's enormous.
Yeah, well, I wonder if it's, if it was one of those where, like, the basement, like, the front door is at a higher elevation than the back door.
Oh, yeah, so I know what you're talking about. So it opens out into
this big studio. I wonder if that's sort of what they were talking about there.
I don't know.
pardon me. And one of those 17 full-time staff members was the creator of Hey Arnold.
Yeah.
Craig Bartlett.
Craig Bartlett.
Yeah. Who we were super excited when we saw in the credits.
We definitely watched two of his earlier shorts. Earlier today.
Claymation as well.
Yeah, which were really, really cool.
Yeah, they're actually pretty cool.
Well, yeah, but what sequence did... oh, no, Craig Bartlett animated the aliens.
Yeah,
and he also animated, what was it, the...
I think he did, I think he probably was responsible for most of that sequence, because he did the human character in that sequence.
Yeah, that's
the captain,
right.
So mm-hmm. I think he probably had, I think he probably was sort of like the main guy on that sequence.
Yeah, like that was just like, this is the one you're going to do. Like,
yeah, I don't know, yeah.
I wonder if he designed some of the characters, too.
Probably. From that one.
It kind of seemed like it.
Yeah, so,
Because, like, stylistically, they didn't really match, like, the Adam and Eve or Becky characters, too. So, they're also Adam, aliens.
Yeah, well, and so. Adam also had that, he had that, that Rankin Bass nose.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's most of it.
That's most of what I got.
I mean, like, the interview
I'm sorry, I'm trying to not yawn as much. We're just really tired.
Yeah, it's fairly late for us.
Yeah.
Later than I realized, even.
Oh, jeez, yeah, it is.
So, oops. But in the end, I mean, like, it is a good movie. It's not what I expected it to be. A little weirder, I think.
I did too.
I think it's because
we watched the Mysterious Stranger thing, but it was out of order of the film. Where, yeah, like, well, do you think it would have been more striking?
That set piece in it.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, because, like, it's just such a tonal shift on the rest of it, where, like, the rest of it's, like, it's fairly light, it's fairly happy and fun, but at the same time, it's like, well, ultimately, he's going to die.
Yeah.
Or he's like, I'm going up to see Haley's Comet so that I can feel complete.
Right,
like,
die
like,
and be reunited like, with my wife.
Yeah, like, this is what I want to do. Right. So, like, they know that, but at the same time, it's structured in such a way that it's, like, this is an adventure for the kids, and that they're both learning more about themselves and how to be able to take care of the ship and how they can eventually get back home.
Right.
So.
Right, and I think that's probably sort of emblematic of Mark Twain's writing, because, like, even Huckleberry Finn is sort of considered a children's book, but I read that for college.
It's...
like, that's the first time I read it, and...
Then a lot of the subject matter is probably not good for kids to handle at that age anyway.
Well, I mean... Also, there's a question of what we consider, you know, children's book, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, then, considering, it was a banned book forever, wasn't it?
Yeah,
But it was because of the language.
Books. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's such a good book, and it's so funny, and it's easily digestible. But, I mean, like... the vast majority of that content is really about racial relations and tensions in the American South in, you know, the early 1900s.
But you would expect something like that coming from both a Southern author, and given the time that it came out, and like then, what was he competing with, like Uncle Tom's Cabin or anything similar? It was in a similar vein of like other criticisms of certain aspects of Southern society at that point in American history.
The short answer is pretty much yes.
Yes,
Uncle Tom's Cabin is, for all it being sort of crappy book, was the most popular book of its time.
Could argue the same thing for 50 Shades of Grey now, wherein like it's more about like there are certain aspects about the message that it's getting forward where it's like this is a topic that most people generally don't want to talk about, but it's obviously a thing that impacts society to a pretty decent extent.
Right.
Much more so the case with Uncle Tom's Cabin than 50 Shades of Grey. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we won't but dive into that.
Don't need to. We don't want to talk about it anyway.
No, we really don't.
No.
But yeah, so I think the fact that this movie sort of plays with like, so the lighter comedic side and also like sort of the dark side of things, like Mysterious Stranger.
Yeah.
I think is probably a good homage to Mark Twain.
Yeah, it's just like it's a very well done retrospective of just his kind of but his sense of humor and just his. Legacy, I guess.
And I think it's interesting because it actually utilizes some of his least known works.
Mm-hmm.
but also obviously has some sort of...
But it also shows...
It all obviously alludes to his more popular works like Tom Sawyer.
Plus it shows a greater appreciation for it. It's like, yeah, he had many facets to his writing style wherein, like, he's not just Tom Sawyer.
Right, exactly. So,
which for a while I was like, oh, I just assumed he made realistic fiction stuff, and it's like, nope.
Well, yeah, Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court.
Yeah.
Man, just...
Which was later made into a Disney movie called A Kid in King Arthur's Court.
Oh, yeah.
Not sure if you're familiar with that one. Oh, man. But, well, no, which had a... it was the same kid that was in Rookie of the Year. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Nope.
It's a good movie. Really like it also had a young Gary Busey in it.
Oh.
Yeah. Great. Before he had the motorcycle accident.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think we could probably wrap it up there.
Yeah, I mean, it's I would recommend watching it, checking it out at the very least, just for the technical and the artistic.
Yeah,
merit.
I mean, like,
holy!
If you're
crap.
Not a fan of claymation,
like
you will be.
You
after
will
this
be.
Movie.
You
like,
will
it's
be.
So
like it's like because you'll just like sit there dumbfounded. Like people actually
like they
made
sat
this.
There and like one thing that they really were big on when they made this movie is. 100% clay.
Yeah, like everything is a practical 100%
effect. Clay. Like, we're like, watching at the end of it when they're at the comet.
Yeah,
you can actually see the strings on the comet.
Which I liked it better because it's like, oh, that's a practical effect too.
Yeah,
like,
we love practical effects.
Which is like, this is not to knock CGI, but it's like since we grew up in like the late 80s, early 90s, we have a much higher appreciation. We don't have a higher appreciation for. We have an appreciation for practical effects.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it formed our childhoods and what we kind of came to know.
Yeah, well,
so,
there's...
Like, I still love Are You Afraid of the Dark? Because of, like, some of the effects are really cheesy, but I find that charming.
Yeah,
because,
no, there's,
like,
there's
it was the 90s.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's what they did with the budget that they had. Like, they wanted to make something look as cool as they possibly could, but they only had so much money to go through with it. And now, even though we can spend a lot of money on CGI, it's just, it
well,
feels...
You don't even need
because,
to, like,
you know what's... There's a tangible object behind that.
Yeah, and there's something to that.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the reasons we love Fright Night.
No, yeah, that's why we love Fright Night. That's why we like, what is it, Little Shop of Horrors, like, Ghostbusters. Like, it's just, like, when you can see all the artistry that goes behind actually making something like that and knowing that that's a physical object that someone had to pour into a mold, paint, put wiring inside of it, lights, everything. It's, like, it gives you a whole better appreciation for just the... craftsmanship that goes into it.
Right, absolutely. Which is in no way to say that, like, CGI isn't also, like,
an art
in its own right.
Yeah.
It's just there's something charming and there's almost, like, an honesty to practical effects like that that have a physical...
Yeah, it's
thing.
Like, there's, I don't know, I guess it's just like, I like the idea of being able to know that that is actually a thing, that if I wanted to go see it at like a museum or something, I probably could.
Yeah.
Because I'd gone to, I'd seen this art gallery thing before that was all about costumes that they'd used in Hollywood films where they had the dude's robe from The Big Lebowski.
Oh my God.
They had one of Scarlett O'Hara's dresses from Gone with the Wind. They had... Spider-Man suits. They had so much stuff.
Yeah.
It was really cool because you can actually see like all the details and like there might be like little tears or something
like
in
the
suit
of
like what's left
that.
Over from it. It's like, ah, that's so cool. Like not only was the actor wearing it, but you get to see that this wasn't just the first one that they had made. Oh, they also had the Addams Family too, which I really liked.
Yeah.
So especially seeing Christopher Lloyd's fat suit. That was pretty great. That was pretty great.
That's outstanding.
But, I would definitely check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's
on Netflix as of the time we recorded this.
Mm-hmm. It's a strange little film, but it's pretty quick. It's about 90 minutes, so
it
might feel a little bit longer, but you'll still enjoy it.
Yeah, so. I think it's
the medium.
It's one of the better paced movies we've watched.
Yeah, I would say so.
So,
but yeah. So, check it out, guys. Adventures of Mark Twain. We found it on Netflix. You can find it there. Or you could probably rent it. Or
Yeah, it was pretty... I mean...
It might even be on the iTunes store. But,
maybe.
Yeah.
It got a release.
But, like, Netflix or your library would probably be your best bet.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, it got a release, like a Blu-ray release, here about 2-3 years ago, so...
Thereabouts, yeah. But yeah, check it out. And if you want to learn more about Will Vinton's animation, just look him up on YouTube and you can
Google
see.
Him.
You'd be surprised how much stuff that he's made.
The man,
like,
the man
it's,
done a bunch.
He's like, he really is like the father of modern like clay animation. Yeah. So, well, I mean, like, he coined the term claymation. Like, come on.
I mean, like, and he's a big, he's obviously sort of a big influence in terms of like stop motion animation.
Definitely.
So.
Yeah.
Check him out, man.
Yeah. He's pretty cool. So, yeah. Thanks, guys. So, thanks for listening. Yep. And, we don't know what the next one's going to be, but
every
we'll figure it out. I think I like the idea that we just do it as a surprise. Yeah. So, but yeah.
So, but if you have suggestions, obviously.
Yeah. Please comment, tweet, let us know.
Whatever.
Comment on here. Comment on the Instagram that are, you can find us on Twitter or my Twitter and my Instagram name are the same. It's TC Trausch. You'll probably just be better off looking in the show notes to see how to spell that because actually spelling it out just takes so much time.
It's very tiring.
And you'll still be like, wait, what? So, like, just look at it.
And my my Twitter handle is lobster_writer. And my Instagram is, I think, like, lobster99.
Yeah, it's lobster99.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I don't post anything interesting on
Instagram. I post sporadically. I don't know.
Well, she posts the graphics, so.
Yeah, I post the graphics and I post, like, other random stuff that I see. But, like, I'm not consistent about it, really. I'm better
our social media habits aside.
Yeah. No. But yeah, so if you have questions or recommendations of stuff you'd like to check out or if you have any observations you'd like to share with us,
point out about us.
Like maybe if we got anything wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably has happened. All right, guys. So
all right, well,
that'll
about you.
Do it with, for us this week.
So yeah, so Animation Station episode 8. Thank you for joining us.
Yep.
We hope you have a great whatever it is you're listening to this to.
Yep.
All right. Bye.